Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, June 19th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Freeze on gambling, in or out? The Champaign City Council's vote on Tuesday on extending a video gaming moratorium until January 23rd will show how serious it is about adding regulations on gambling providers. A temporary moratorium, which bans installing and operating video gaming terminals in newly licensed liquor-serving establishments, was passed on February 21st and extended on April 11th. It would expire on July 18th unless extended again. Council members say the moratorium's purpose is to allow time for analysis and deliberation about more gambling regulations. In Champaign, where more than $500 million has been wagered since September 2012, video gaming is regulated through liquor licenses and not a specific video gaming license, which is the method Urbana uses. Deputy City Manager Matt Schlossley said there will be a City Council meeting this fall about the possible regulation methods, including ones used by cities nearby or of comparable size. If the Council decides on a path then, he said, there will be enough time to prepare it before January 23rd, plus some extra time in case of a delay. I think Council was pretty clear that the majority is interested in regulating video gaming in some way, which we don't do now, noting that members are especially concerned about gambling parlors or cafes. There are 60 places in Champaign with licensed video gambling, according to data from the Illinois Gaming Board. Some 28 of them are bars, restaurants, 17 are cafes, parlors, and the rest are bingo halls, fraternal establishments, gas stations, bowling alleys, music venues, hotels, or veterans establishments. Some council members have been concerned with this type of gambling becoming commonplace in Champaign. Council member Greg Stock said the gambling is particularly present in low-income areas. I think that makes it borderline predatory for people in bad financial circumstances. Other council members have said they want to avoid government overreach. I don't want government stepping in to exercise moral judgment every time someone spends their money in a manner I wouldn't spend mine or in a way that's foolish and wasteful. Rochley said he isn't aware of the city receiving any negative feedback about the moratorium. He also said applications for operating the gambling terminals have dried up since it was first allowed. Illinois' Video Gaming Act, which legalized terminals in places licensed for alcohol consumption on the premises, was enacted July 2009. It also allows municipalities to ban gambling via an ordinance, which was done by Chicago. Iwo Jima vet can't forget pals who fell, from Monticello. It has been 72 years since Marine Corporal Les Gadberry fought his way across Iwo Jima, and he still remembers the names of the men who fell to Japanese fire. But as he tells the story of a friend who fell on top of him and said, "Gadberry, I'm dying," his eyes start to tear up. "I'm sorry," he says, "that hasn't happened before." At 94, the man who fought in Bougainville, Guam, and most intensely on Iwo Jima, is sorry because he got emotional, that he let the story of friends hit by mortar fire, small arms fire, and even anti-aircraft shells finally wear him down. This after talking about being blasted senseless into the air and a landing on his feet at Iwo Jima, or a small shrapnel wound on Guam. He never got a Purple Heart. After 2 years in the South Pacific fighting Japanese soldiers desperate to protect their homelands, the Marines were supposed to be routed out, but Gadberry's squad kept fighting on. Gadberry grew up in Monticello and, like many, volunteered for his 4 years in the Marines, the first to land on enemy-held islands along the chain to Japan. After basic training, he spent almost all his time in the service as a member of C Company, 1st Battalion, of the newly organized 9th Marine Regiment as a machine gunner until April 23, 1945. It started nice enough, 2 weeks on a large converted luxury liner, the USS Mount Vernon, and on a zigzag unescorted course to New Zealand. Every island had its challenges even before combat started. on Guadalcanal during the nights, this had to be the worst place for mosquitoes one could ever find. Since this was a no combat zone, we slept under mosquito nets. If your elbow or leg touched the net, the result was dozens of bites immediately. In October 1943, he boarded the USS Crescent City for Bougainville Island in the Solomon Islands. The island had 6 airfields and an estimated 45,000 to 60,000 Japanese. He landed in the first wave. The sky was nearly blackened by so many airbursts. Shortly after landing and moving inland, artillery fire started falling on us. It wasn't a heavy barrage, but well-spaced rounds were hitting our positions. No one had dug a foxhole yet, but things changed in a hurry. Everyone would be digging, a shell would hit, and instantly no one could be seen as they were flattened on the ground. Then everyone was up instantly and digging in again. He saw his first dead Japanese soldier on top of a coconut tree. Thereafter, we gave our undivided attention to these treetops, for others also held live snipers. Moving inland was another skirmish after another. Disease and filth added to the danger. We were told that a few of us at a time could go to the rear and get clean clothing at a supply depot. The ones we were wearing at the time were the same dungarees we wore when boarding ship a month ago. Ours were now a mess and falling off us. Thanksgiving Day was a turkey dinner, but back to the front line the same day. Christmas Day came and went just like any other day, and finally they were relieved. In July 1944, his men landed on Guam. We were proud to take back an American possession after the Japanese took it. 4 days after the famous flag raising on Iwo Jima, Gadbury was there. He kept his head down in the foxhole when he could, but Japanese soldiers would appear out of tunnels or caves and the bullets would fly. The memories are horrifying. He said 56 of the 206 men in his company were killed. Out of our 6 machine gun squads, both the number 1 and number 2 gunners were killed in 5 of these squads during the battle. Several of these machine gunners were killed the first day, including Randall Hackenberg, who was my number 1 gunner during the Guam campaign. He never received a major medal and does not consider himself a hero. We were doing a job that had to be done. After the war, he married Norma Gregory of Mowiqua. Both graduated from Illinois State University. They have 5 children, and he's retired after a long career as a teacher and coach in Atwood and Monticello. Also on the front page, she's going to fly. She grew up in Champaign, and now Zena Cardman is headed to space. A trip to space wasn't exactly a childhood dream for newly minted astronaut Zena Cardman, an Urbana native, creative writer, and microbiologist who studies otherworldly life forms for a living. Her path to NASA involved a top-notch biology teacher, 2 older brothers who made sure she wasn't a princess, cave slime, and a trip to Antarctica, among other stops. Cardman, 29, a National Science Foundation research fellow at Penn State, is one of 12 scientists chosen for NASA's 2017 class of astronaut candidates. She's the only graduate student and one of the youngest selected out of 18,000-plus applicants, the largest pool in the space agency's history. "It's really, really humbling," Cardman said. "I think we all have a little bit of imposter syndrome. I'm thinking, who did I fool to get here?" No need, according to her proud parents. She's a very determined young woman who isn't afraid to work hard and deal with the details to do something right. "And she has a deep curiosity in things nobody knows about," said her father, Larry Cardman, a nuclear physicist who spent 20 years at the University of Illinois. "I think she's as fine a person for the job as you could find. Plus, she's a lot of fun and somewhat fearless," said her mother, former Champaign librarian Helen Andrea Cardman. Zena spent the first 5 years of her life in a house at 909 West Charles Street in Champaign's Clark Park, supervised by 2 teenage brothers, Michael and Andrew, who regarded it as their sacred duty to make sure that she didn't become a spoiled little girl. She clearly inherited her father's love of science, but her mother attributes Zena's sense of humor and fearless factor to the boys, who would let her watch The Simpsons when they babysat and took her out for after-hours sledding at the nearby Champagne Country Club on rare snowy days. They'd send her down the hill screaming. They had a big hand, I think, in who she has become. Zena attended preschool at Champagne's Early Learning Center at Kirby and Prospect Avenues, a really rich and wonderful environment. She spent many happy hours in Champagne's extensive parks and devoured stacks of books from the Champagne Library. In 1993, Larry Cardman took a job at the Jefferson National Accelerator Facility in Virginia, and the family relocated to Williamsburg. The Cardmans have been back to Champaign-Urbana for weddings and other occasions, and Zena's Aunt Liz, Elizabeth Cardman, still lives here. I do feel very much like I have roots there. Zena remembers watching meteor showers with her mom as a child, looking up at the stars and feeling a sense of awe and wonder. But she always planned to be a novelist until she met a phenomenal high school biology teacher who turned her on to science. He was a huge influence on me. She had an assistantship during high school at the Virginia Institute for Marine Science and did a research project with a professor at the College of William and Mary. She majored in biology at the University of North Carolina, where she also earned a master's in marine science. But she kept a foot in the literary world, minoring in creative writing and editing a poetry journal. She initially did research in neurobiology and cell biology, but then she read an article by a student who had gone to Antarctica to study tiny organisms that thrive in extreme, otherworldly environments. That's where I caught the bug, literally. I knew I wanted to see that environment for myself. At 19, she had no professional contact, so she shamelessly emailed everyone I could find online. Seriously, 80 or more different scientists. Most didn't respond or didn't have space or funding to take her on, but a NASA scientist named Darlene Lim suggested she join NASA's Pavilion Lake Research Project in British Columbia, Canada. There, researchers were studying tiny life forms called microbialities deep under the lake surface. They almost look like little tufts of cauliflower or artichokes. The structures they build can be fossilized, which tells us a lot about what was happening on early Earth when these were the only life form of life around. That in turn helps us to try and understand what to look for on another planet if we were to search for evidence of life. The scientists were also figuring out logistics for navigating research in unusual environments as preparation for work in space. Divers and single-person submarines collected samples on the lake bottom as Cardman and other scientists back at Mission Control guided them. She worked at Pavilion Lake every summer from 2008 to 2015, and last year began work at NASA's Balsett Project in Hawaii and Craters of the Moon National Park in Idaho, where the volcanoes and lava terrain are seen as similar to Mars. She's also worked with Palmer Long-Term Ecological Research Group in Antarctica and sailed with the Sea Education Association as assistant engineer aboard a 135-foot-tall ship. Her work involves studying tiny organisms that thrive in extreme conditions around thermal vents deep in the ocean, in the Arctic, or in the sediments affected by the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and can provide clues about life on early Earth and beyond. She is now pursuing a doctoral degree in geosciences at Penn State, studying interactions between rocks and strange microbes that grow on the walls of damp, dark caves that never see sunlight. Cave slime is my PhD work, she says. Cardman doesn't recall a single moment when she decided to become an astronaut. Rather, it's ebbed and flowed in my consciousness for the past 10 years. I think we were getting clues a few years ago when she got her pilot's license, her mom said, recalling how her daughter explained how it would help her qualify for astronaut training. Cardman first applied to NASA in 2012, but she was too young and lacked experience. This time she knew the odds might be against her because she's still a graduate student, but I decided to go for it anyway. I had nothing to lose. She filled out the application on the NASA website in February 2016, found out the next day that 18,000 other people had applied, and thought, oh, well, there goes that. I'll try again next time. 6 months later, she was sitting in her living room when an unfamiliar caller rang her phone, completely out of the blue. She almost didn't pick up, but then answered and heard a voice say, "This is the astronaut selection office. We'd like you to come in for an interview." I think I just sat there stupidly grinning for several seconds before I managed to speak. It felt very surreal. She went through an interview a week and a half later with 120 other semifinalists. They don't want you to be overly prepared, where she got to know the other 9 people in her small group. She made the cut to 50 finalists, went through another interview, and then got the big news on May 25th. She had steeled herself for rejection based on the absolutely amazing candidates she had met. All of us just had a blast. I'm so lucky. There were so many people who would have done just a phenomenal job. One of the coolest parts is how different everyone has been. They have such diverse experiences, from medical doctors to pilots to engineers to a scientist from the Mars rover team, and me, the grad student. We all love working in teams with groups of people, whether that was on a submarine or in an Air Force squadron or in the Antarctic. That's a crucial trait for people who will spend months together on a space mission and depend on each other for survival. 5 of the 12 astronauts are women, and Carmen is conscious of being a role model, touched by the letters she's already received from students and teachers. One of her friends has a daughter who watched the NASA announcement and said, "Wow, how cool that you can do this as a woman. I want to do this when I grow up." "It brings tears to my eyes," Carmen said, "and then there are kids, too, who are completely unfazed by it. That's really cool, too. We're moving into a time where it's not surprising that a woman can be an astronaut." There's no specific mission lined up yet for this crop of astronauts. They first have to go through 2 years of training, which will start August 21st at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. It will include everything from learning how to speak Russian to flying F-38 supersonic jets and the protocols for spacewalking. Once they graduate, they'll be assigned to a flight, possibly to the International Space Station or something beyond low Earth orbit. In the meantime, Cardman has a wedding to plan. She's engaged to Miles Sanders, a scientist she met on a research ship in the Gulf of Mexico, studying the effects of the BP oil spill. He works on the boat Nautilus, a project of the Ocean Exploration Trust, which takes scientists on ocean research projects and does public outreach. As for the big question, is she scared about spaceflight and not the wedding? I don't think any of us are scared. There's such an amazing team of scientists and engineers, people who work out all those problems, people who train us. I think responding to anything that would arise is something to be second nature by the time we actually get there. Helen Cardman has a slightly different take. "As her mom, I will be scared," she admitted, "but it's something that she has really dreamed about for a while now. Parents want their kids to fulfill their dreams and be happy, so I'm really happy for her." "My mother would say, when I was a young mother, you have to let your children fly. You can't hold them too tight. Now I'm thinking, Mom, here she is. She's going to fly." Another article on the front page is, "The mall a safe place to shop. Despite 3,000 calls to CPD since 2011, most are nonviolent." Since 2011, Champaign police have fielded about 470 calls a year about something happening at Marketplace Mall, from reports of shoplifting to fights in the food court. But the call that was made shortly after 9 p.m. on Memorial Day, just after stores closed their doors for the night, was especially troubling. An argument that broke out in the vicinity of the Finish Line, an athletic footwear and apparel store, had led to at least one gunshot being fired. Details were scarce, and 20 days later, it's still not known who fired the gun or if anyone was hit. Witnesses reported seeing one person bleeding from the head, but authorities couldn't confirm it was caused by a bullet. Incidents as serious as that one are rare. The last report of a shooting at the mall came in 2011, when a Milwaukee man who was later sentenced to 55 years in prison for firing shots at a man outside Lens Crafters over a dispute at a Champaign bar earlier in the day. But calls from Marketplace to Champaign police about other matters happen frequently. In this year alone, there were 143 before the calendar turned to June. And between 2011 and the end of last month, Champaign police responded to 3,030 calls to the mall. A News Gazette analyst of data provided by police revealed that one of those calls was for assault, two were for sexual assaults, 28 were for harassment, 38 were for battery, and 42 were for fights. In a statement from Marketplace's owner, Chicago-based GGP General Manager Dennis Robertson defended the mall's safety. Marketplace has over 100 tenants, hosts millions of visitors per year, and operates much like a mini-city. Our security diligently patrols the shopping center 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and provides assistance to our tenants and shoppers. For security, the mall contracts with Aurora-based Andy Frayne Services, which didn't respond to requests for comment for this story. But if an incident rises to the level that additional help is needed, Andy Frayne will work with the Champaign Police. We work cooperatively with the Champaign Police Department when an incident arises that requires additional authority and ensuring the safety of our shopping center. Calls to CPD doesn't always come from mall security. Shoppers may also contact local police directly. Any citizen can call the Champaign Police Department to address a concern at the mall, and mall security can handle escalate according to the incident. Many of the police calls to the mall since 2011 were relatively minor and didn't affect shopper safety. A lot of these things have nothing to do with the actual safety of the mall. Of the 3,030 calls, about a third were related to theft. 7 calls concerned robberies, 11 were burglaries, 326 were designated as thefts, and 730 were over instances of shoplifting. Following the alleged shooting on Memorial Day, officials declined to provide further information about security procedures at Marketplace, citing strategic reasons. While the safety and well-being of our shoppers and retailers is our number one priority every day, we never publicly discuss the details of our security program because to do so would compromise its effectiveness. And from the business page, Solid Roots, JSM co-founder, helped build family business from Champaign. This year's Parkland College Foundation Entrepreneur of the Year has been in the real estate business most of his life, but almost ended up selling flowers. My father and both brothers ended up getting degrees in ornamental horticulture, said Jeff Hartman, co-founder of JSM Companies. Dad wanted to become a florist, and then after the war realized that money wasn't in being a florist. Instead, his father, Lion Hartman, entered the construction business. There was so much expansion going on after the war, so he realized he'd better become a builder, and did. And that's probably a good thing, or I'd be running a flower shop. Hartman will receive the V. Dale Cozad Entrepreneur of the Year Award this Tuesday at the 8th Annual Entrepreneur of the Year Banquet, an annual fundraiser for the Parkland College Entrepreneurial Program. JSM was technically formed in 1974 by Jeff Hartman with his brothers Stephen and Michael, but has its roots in their father's construction business. He developed a 24-unit efficiency building that was well received by the market. JSM now manages more than 1,600 campus area apartments and leases space to 91 businesses in some of the busiest locations in Campus Town, including the Town Place Suites Complex and the building on Green Street where Panera is located. Jeff Hartman is an entrepreneur in every sense of the word. He and his family have grown the business from building apartment buildings to managing a portfolio of apartments, office buildings, and retail centers, Parkland President Tom Ramage said in an email statement. JSM takes pride in the construction and maintenance of their properties, which have helped the company create and maintain an excellent reputation. Hartman attended Southern Illinois University, Parkland College, and the University of Illinois for business, though he never graduated. I wouldn't say I was an extremely good student, though I really think I could have been. I was really good at math. But Hartman says the key to being an entrepreneur isn't something you learn in school. It's the standard stuff. We're working hard. You're not allowing things to not work out. A little luck doesn't hurt. And being strong in several areas is very important. Greg Cozad, son of V. Dale Kozad said Hartman has improved the community with his properties. Jeff's an outstanding businessman, a great family man, and has added to the value of the community with the quality of his developments. JSM chooses its locations carefully and is committed to keeping them up to date. We spend an awful lot of money redoing our apartments and making sure that we have as much of a competitive advantage as there can be. Upon learning he's this year's awardee, Hartman said, "It's quite the honor. When you stop to think about the other recipients in years past, I'm not sure I'm really in that group, quite honestly. But it's certainly nice to have JSM companies be recognized, and that's how I perceive it." And a letter to the editor. MTD buses cause CU road damage. I'm sure that many were as shocked as I was to read the News Gazette article that linked the destruction of the Country Fair Shopping Center parking lot to the MTD 320 buses a day traffic pounding it into rubble. Okay, maybe that wasn't so shocking after all. Drive down any street on which there is an MTD bus route and you can visually see and tactically feel the pavement destruction caused by the enormously oversized MTD buses. John Street is a good example as any, but any other bus route will suffice. These gigantic behemoths have literally ruined dozens of roads in Champaign, roads that were never designed for the huge unit axle loadings that the MTD buses are subject to. Never mind that the buses are essentially empty for a huge part of the time. Don't believe me, use your eyes. The vehicles themselves constitute an impossible load for our city streets to withstand. Maybe you're willing to tolerate this destruction for the sake of public transportation, which somehow cannot make it as a form of transportation without heavy taxpayer subsidies. If that isn't enough for you, file a Freedom of Information request and then feel your blood boil at the six-figure salaries of the leadership of the MTD and six-figure pensions for some of them, too. When will we ever rein in this pox on our community? We need a mass transit system. We definitely don't need the MTD version of one. L. Daniel Metz, Champaign. And owners, get your dog off my lawn. What and who gives dog owners the right to let their dogs do their dirty business on my yard or anybody else's yard besides their own? If I wanted dog doo-doo and urine in my yard, I would have a dog. And if I did have a dog, I would not have the nerve to let it go on other people's yards. People might say a responsible dog owner will pick up the doo-doo, but what about the urine? If I wanted green splotches in my yard, I would spray fertilizer spots. Dog owners, please keep your dogs in your house all day and no mess. Take the dog for a walk in your yard until he relieves himself. I do not find it entertaining to look out my window and see a dog pooping and peeing in my yard. Harry Brandon Muhammad. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, June 19th. Please stay tuned.